When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app. Ba-da-ba-ba-ba.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.
Welcome to the Docs Who Lift podcast, where we distill and simplify the complexities of a healthy lifestyle, exercise, medicine, and weight loss. We're excited to bring you a podcast that's a prescription for clinical practice, scientific recommendations, and just real life. This is the Docs Who Lift podcast.
Hey, and welcome back to the Docs Who Lift podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Spencer Nadolski, and my co-host, Dr. Carl Nadolski Jr.
Yeah, hi.
He's not the only endocrinologist in the house, as we have special guest, Dr. Salas Whalen of New York Endocrinology, and one of the coolest Instagram personalities, other than the Doc Who Lifts, but I think she's a Doc Who Lifts too. So
she is a Doc Who Lifts.
Yeah. Welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm really excited about having a discussion with you guys.
Yeah. You're famous. You're always on the news. I see you on these little talking head type of things with like kind of, I don't want to say call them like ignorant, but they kind of are ignorant. You kind of, it's really cool to see you go, whoa, wait a second. That's not actually the truth. And you correct them. I love it.
I think that's our responsibility, is like to educate people either in the medical field or non-medical field, just to give them information.
Hence the podcast.
Exactly.
So you're a doc who lifts, is that right?
I do lift since in my 20s. I love weightlifting.
Well, tell us and everyone else a little bit of your background, you know, where you're from, what got you into, you know, whatever schools you went to, what got your interest in endocrine and obesity medicine?
So I'm from Mexico. I'm originally from Mexico. I did medical school in Mexico. And since medical school, I always was interested in diabetes and endocrinology, because in Mexico, diabetes is the number one cause of death of everything, motor vehicle accidents, cancer. So it was like the first disease that I heard my dad has it, my grandfather has it. So there's out of every five Mexicans, three have diabetes.
Wow.
So that's pretty high. And then as I started evolving in diabetes, I evolved more into fitness, nutrition, that is part of the diabetes treatment, right? Whenever you talk about glucose control, you have to talk about weight and or exercise and eating healthy. And then that became part of my lifestyle. And then as time passes, then I came to the US when I was 25, as I finished medical school over there and did my residency fellowship here in the US and Albert Einstein in New York and then in Baltimore. Okay. I grew more interested in weight loss because you cannot treat diabetes without weight loss, right? And many other diseases. Yeah. I mean, we've built subspecialties due to the complications of obesity, and always weight loss is involved. And once you guide the patient to the journey of weight loss, it's really fulfilling. It's really fulfilling to see the transformation on the patient. And I'm sure both of you see this, that when a patient comes in, they may come with an idea of weight loss as maybe something external, right? Or physical. But in the trajectory of the journey, when you guide them the right way with maintaining muscle and concentrating on fat loss and not just total body weight loss, there's a shift in the patient where they start to feel fit, strong, and then it becomes part of their DNA.
Yeah.
It's like a mother and your children seeing them grow up, and you're like, oh, now you're set, because now it becomes part of their body, of their life. Right?
Yes, very much.
It's amazing. It's like, I always talk about this vicious cycle, you know, part of the obesity physiology, pathophysiology, the genetics, all the things that happen throughout their lives, and now the body's working against them. And like you said, they may not be exercising much, but then when we get that cycle going the right direction, and then their activity goes up, even if it's not true exercise or whatever it is, all the healthy things, they just feel better, everything's better, treats the underlying driving force of their other complications. Yeah, and then we get into a better cycle.
It becomes like their external appearance becomes secondary, because now they feel mentally better, physically better, more confident, stronger. And it's really nice to see that transition from the reason that they came in and then where they are at the end of the journey, right?
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's absolutely. So what's on the inside that counts from head to toe?
Exactly.
You started after you got into lifestyle stuff, you went through med school, residency, and then fellowship. You started your own practice. Is that right?
I started my own practice. Out of training, I worked for other groups, right? Or for other providers, doctors that had several works working for them. But with obesity, it's such a deep discussion with the patient, right? Some patients or the majority have struggled with their weight since they're children or teenagers. Mm-hmm. So you're dealing with decades of trauma, of mental health. It's a very vulnerable conversation to have with a patient that I could have never done it in a 15-minute block or other somebody else dictating how many patients I have to see in a day in my schedule mm-hmm. without me providing that opening and allowing the patient to tell their story without rushing them, right? I always mm-hmm. knew I could offer more for the patient if I had more time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which goes to the bigger issue of our broken healthcare system that we all got to keep advocating for.
It is. It is.
We all need more time.
It is a shame. I'm sure every doctor knows that they can mm-hmm. do more for the patient if they have more time, right?
Yeah.
And that was maybe the reason that I wanted to open my own practice, to have autonomy of my time.
Yeah.
And autonomy to provide the care that I see fit for my patient, right? Following guidelines and all of that. Mm-hmm. Because also when you work for a big institution, you have to really be in a mental square and follow what they do and recommend what they say. And you don't have more freedom to design maybe a better treatment plan for the patient.
Yeah.
I love it. You're speaking to us.
Yeah.
On a visceral level. So you often discuss using incretin. We're a big shills for incretins. We talk about all the time that for anybody listening, incretins, the GLP-1s or GIP now and GLP-1. But you talk about like how it's important to have someone who knows how to prescribe these medicines, because if you don't, you might see poor outcomes or things that, you know, some of the myths that you see out there, like some of the articles, Ozempic face and all these things and all these muscle loss or whatever. So
and inappropriate prescribing.
Yeah,
which inappropriate might lead prescribing. Us to the next issues that are coming up this summer that we might talk about. So
yeah. So what are you seeing out there? What are you seeing on like people that are inappropriately prescribing or not experienced with these, and you're seeing these patients or whatever?
I mean, I always say that not because you have a medical license you should prescribe anything because just you can. Like, I can prescribe oncology medication, chemo. I don't do it, right? Because I'm going to hurt the patient. I don't know what to expect. Same weight loss drugs, right? I feel like it's such an evolving field that we're still discovering some of its effects, some of its potential effects, positive or negatives, right? And I do feel like the success of the treatment and the safety of the treatment has to do almost 100% on who's prescribing that drug, right? I actually had the pleasure of meeting the person that developed or found the GLP in the Gila monster, which was in like in the 1990s, because he's in the BA.
Was it John Eng?
Yes. And that was the first time, and we were like so amazed of
that's so
his
cool.
finding. And he, it's because the venom of the Gila produces pancreatitis in its victims. And that's what drove him to think, what does it affect? Does it have in the pancreas? And boom, this is where we are, right?
Yeah, amazing.
But the incretins are not new drugs, right? They're available almost. We have data for more than 2 decades now.
Yeah.
And you fine tune the medication with experience as anything in medicine, right? Seeing how patients respond, the side effects, how can you minimize side effects? And that takes time, and that takes a lot of experience to fine tune a healthy plan for the patient. Because the problem is, and this goes back to our healthcare system, I guess, and the current guidelines of using the BMI, right? With the BMI, we're missing so much information that we don't know what the patient comes in, right? Many times they have high body fat and low muscle mass, and then you put in a weight loss treatment, they're going to lose at the same rate, right? So we're going to make patients the skinny fat or sarcopenic obesity that we're going to start seeing. And I predict that unfortunately we're going to have side effects or complications that were not seen in all these 2 decades, because just more people are going to start using them without the knowledge and the preparation. I always tell doctors, it's fine. We need more. There's only 7,000 obesity board certified physicians in the U.S. I mean, I cannot see everybody. You guys cannot see everybody.
Right.
The more people that start treating patients, because patients, any specialty, go see some patients with obesity. Any specialty is a missed opportunity to have a discussion about weight loss medications, right? But if you cannot do that, if you want to be part of the in crowd right now, you prepare yourself, right? And take a course, become an obesity board certified physician. Do it responsibly if you really want to offer help for their patients.
Yeah, it's interesting, you know, because it's, I actually, when you were talking about that and you compared it to oncology drugs, I shared it. When I talk about that, I often use, I don't know, like rheumatology drugs or something. It's like, oh my God, I'm not going to even think about those things. And then, you know, some of the feedback is, well, hey, you know, primary care, we're the ones that are on the front lines. And I don't disagree with that. You know, and they have to also take care of not only obesity, but a lot of the obesity complications, right? All the way through type 2 diabetes, heart disease, all that other stuff. And specialists like us, you know, we need to somehow provide some oversight. We can't just be in our little silos. That kind of goes back to, I guess it was before the podcast started, we were talking about my department and how I want to really help the front lines and kind of oversee primary care as opposed to, you know, taking their patients, finding a way to do that. And that goes back to the broken healthcare system too. But it's interesting, you know, like say for primary care, who they do need to be addressing this, at what level is their comfort? Because, you know, Spencer's a family practice doctor, but happened to, you know, go in and specialize in obesity and lipids. But I guess, and we were obviously internists, at least for some period of time. And I don't remember ever being like, say, comfortable with, you know, rheumatology drugs or oncology drugs. We happen to have an interest in do extra education, whatever, in obesity and diabetes. I guess I'd be interested to hear about, you know, other primary care doctors who have whatever comfort levels in whatever sort of specialty, you know, and to your point, like, yeah, it's kind of a slippery slope, I guess.
It is.
Right? We need them, but yeah, we got to, it needs to be done correctly. So
what I found really interesting, and I'm sure you think the same way, even as trained as an endocrinologist, I didn't know as much as I know about obesity as I do now after becoming obesity board certified than as an endocrinologist. Mm-hmm. So even as a specialty in metabolism, because mm-hmm. again, this is such an evolving field, obesity medicine, right? That yeah. I didn't feel competent. I didn't have the knowledge that I have now after I became obesity board certified physician and after treating many patients exclusively for obesity, right? Also, the important thing for primary care is to remember that before, when we talked about obesity, it was eat less, exercise more. No harm done, right? We were not helping, but right. We weren't doing any harm.
Right, we weren't helping.
But now it's like, okay, eat less, exercise more, and take this medication. They're not going to have the time if they're talking about hypertension and their diabetes, their osteoarthritis, other things that they come for primary care, right? They're not mm-hmm. going to have the time to dedicate to explaining the medications, side effects, and then fine-tuning or keeping in touch with the patient often enough to discuss side effects and how to help them alleviate it, right? So it is a slippery slope.
Yeah. Here's a question. How do you overcome those, like just in a private practice? I know I do, the way that I've always done it is like electronic videos and stuff to where they can go watch it on their own. But like, what do you do to overcome that?
So I spend with a new patient anywhere from 45 minutes to an hour.
That's good.
And then with my follow-ups, I spend 30 minutes. That's so great. Even though I'm an endocrinologist, I would say 90% of my practice now is obesity medicine. So when they come to me, I can dedicate that time for the patient, specifically and exclusively about obesity and weight. And I think that's why my patients, I don't think I've ever had to stop any incretin from side effects.
That's great.
Do you have any dietitians or diabetes educators who work with you either? It's just like really, really just you. See, I'm luckier that I also have pretty good time, even though, you know, I worked in a big system and now we're starting our own department with a smaller system. And I think we're going to do better with the overall, you know, way we do things. But, you know, I still only really have 40 plus or my, you know, plus maybe some more time minutes with a new patient. 20 maybe plus some little extra time with a follow-up patient. But I'm lucky that I have, and I'm able to know who I get as far as like diabetes educators, registered dietitians who can continue the conversation. So I can see the person for, you know, 45 minutes or so, but then, okay, now my educator is going to come show you the pen, go through it a little bit more, talk about, you know, nutritional, you know, ways to minimize side effects and, you know, even still reinforce some of the exercise that we emphasize so much and all that stuff. So I'm lucky in that regard.
I feel because it's part of my lifestyle and that's what I train, I feel very comfortable giving a ballpark of what a patient needs to be doing. And this, again, this is not a diet, right? I don't want many ask me, should I follow a diet? And this is us removing the patient from that, right? From the diet idea that I have to count calories, that I have to follow this, that I have to follow that. It's more liberating a little bit the patient from that huge responsibility of them watching everything more so that goes into their mouth and how it's going to affect, right? I mean, it can tip to the other point. The few times that I've seen patients not lose weight on medications is when the food that they're choosing is still very high caloric dense. Mm-hmm. Right? If they have half a portion, they still may have 1500 calories, right? So yeah. I do make the patients conscious of what they choose still counts, but it's to give them a little bit more of a balance, right? To move that obsession of the plate in front of them.
Yeah. Which of course these medications help them minimize that food noise and the, you know, the thinking too much about it and all that stuff. And it's easier for them to make some of these quality choices. Yeah. I do the same thing as far as the diet stuff. I love talking about diet, but I only have so much time. So I give them a kind of the basic initial stuff for them to make some adjustments and then let the dietitians go from there. But I guess, yeah. So if people are drinking sugary drinks and putting butter in their coffee, like some of the people out there still seem to push, then I don't know how much the meds were.
I think the butter in the coffee was like 10 years ago type of thing.
Did we finally put the kibosh on that?
I think we did. I mean, we were part of it. Part
of
that.
I'm going to take not some all credit of for it.
It was ghee. It was not actually protein. It was like the ghee, right?
Yeah. It was putting real sticks butter. Sticks of butter.
Kerrygold butter.
Yeah.
And then it turned into the ghee.
And then it turned into the ghee.
And that was the thing.
If you look up our name in Bulletproof Coffee, you'll see some editorials and videos out there from that's our way back when I presented at the first ACE meeting I ever went to in 2014. That's when I ended up on that MedPage Today video because it was just a case study of a guy that shot his lipids through the roof just because he was drinking Bulletproof Coffee. And that kind of took us down that rabbit hole.
What? Do you do insurance? You take cash, or how do you do both, or anything like that?
I don't take insurance for the same reason, so I can have the time, and that's why I can dedicate time for my patients and not feel rushed. I mean, you guys know, and this goes back again with the healthcare system that we are, and the training that we get too, right? I feel like when you're in residency or fellowship or any training, the option of private practice is never mentioned. Right. Or they swing you away. Oh, private practice is dead. You're not going to survive as a solo practitioner. You have to belong to a group. You have to go. You come almost brainwashed that that's the only way that you can practice medicine. But in that way, they're taking all our autonomy from our hands, right? Mm-hmm. And our time and our time with our family. We're still people, right? I feel like, but I feel like doctors are the only professionals that are very held to a very high standard of sainthood, like almost as like the priest and the doctor, right?
It's true.
We should be free. We should not complain. We should not have days off. We cannot get sick. I mean, it's almost like, we're humans. And what I realized is that if you are mentally healthy, if you're physically healthy as a doctor, socially, emotionally healthy, you're a better doctor. You will do better, right? Because
you're
still enjoying your work. You're still enjoying being a doctor.
Yeah, think about the burnout because of our healthcare system. Think about, and that goes back to the primary care, how we have to find a way to support our primary care friends better. But, you know, something going back to who should be, you know, prescribing medications or, you know, that concern, what you're talking about, you know, is very different than, say, the cash-based clinics and spas out there that are just giving, you know, Ozempic, Wegovy, and Mounjaro to like everybody who comes through the door, right? So that's, you know, that's a problem. I don't know if you see, you know, where you are. I don't see that a lot around my area in Michigan, but, you know, the East and West Coast, maybe more. I don't know.
I have patients that are well-educated, professional, and they come with compounded semaglutide, right? Where there's a lot of functional physicians or doctors that always offer the compounded versus the real medication. So I do, and very something very funny, a colleague of mine, friend here, Dr. Lara Devkan, I don't know if you follow her on Instagram, she told me, she said, oh, I thought of you the other day. And I said, why? Because she's like, because now everybody's prescribing this medication. And it takes me back when everybody started putting Botox and fillers, right? That it was not just the the plastic surgeon that was doing that, but now like fast nurse practice, I mean, everybody's fillers. And that's when all the complications and bad reputation, right, got out of it. And it's like, and I thought that this is going to happen to you. Now everybody's going to prescribe this medication and they're going to give it a bad rep to the procedure, to the drug itself. Right.
Yeah.
And I, now I see it. I like, oh yes, this is true.
Yeah. And it kind of has happened. I mean, you know, the media, the social media, while it's raised the awareness to a little bit of an inappropriate degree, right, along with all these things, there's also been the inappropriate concerns raised that we, or those who know how to prescribe it or whatever, can mitigate, you know, like the whole, like you said, the Ozempic face, or the we've done like four podcasts on the low, the lean mass loss with, with semaglutide because of Peter Attia, who, and again, I'm not going to get into what, whoever he's prescribing this to, but he's, you know, he's telling everyone that all his patients are losing all their muscle and all these other things.
It's two-thirds.
It's like, whoa, hold on. What kind, first of all, what, are you only seeing patients without obesity and you're giving these meds to?
Or he should not be prescribing it, right?
Right. No, he shouldn't. He has zero. Well, okay, I'm not going to bash him because he's a smart, I think he means well, but that's not his specialty.
Yeah.
So to some degree, we got to stay in our lanes. I know people don't always like to hear that, but you know, I certainly do. God, I don't go out of my lane because that doesn't seem right.
And it's not fair for the patient. It's not the safest for the patient either, right? It's not just about masses or quantity. It's about quality. I always say it's more about quality, the quality of care. And that's the reason that I went into private practice. And that's the reason that I don't take insurance, is because I believe more in quality than quantity.
Yeah. Are patients able to, though, take your bill and give it to their insurance? Because isn't that something that people do in private practice?
They all reimburse. They make it 80% reimbursed. They make it some percentage reimbursed. But usually all patients get some reimbursement.
How do you get your patients to lift weights? Because you talk about that. I mean, obviously, we're docs who lift. We love it when our patients lift weights. But you talk about it, too.
Yeah, because I do body compositions on every visit. Mm-hmm. And I think it helps the patient a lot to visualize the muscle loss, right?
Mm-hmm.
And what I found incredible, and it blows my mind every time, is to see how muscle, it's part of the weight loss treatment. It's part of how much they're going to lose and how much body fat they're going to lose. Because I've seen many patients that they lose 20 pounds, maybe, and they lose 5 or 6 of muscle, their percentage fat goes up, right? So muscle mass will help it or make it more difficult for the weight loss. It's part of the treatment. So when patients can see that visually, how it's the muscle loss is affecting their fat loss, even though they lost 20 pounds and they were happy, and now they see, oh no, I didn't even lose fat, I just lost muscle. It changes something on the patient. And once they start seeing muscle build up, they get hooked. I mean, you know, when you lift weights and you see the results and you feel stronger, it just becomes part of, you don't want to go back ever to not feeling like that, right?
Yeah.
So I think patients visualizing and then seeing the results of their effort, it just gets them into weightlifting and exercising.
That's great.
I just tend to beg and plead.
Please lift some weights.
How's that going?
I mean, to some degree, it does well. I'm just telling you, if you can prioritize anything, we got to do some strength training. And I just talk about the health benefits, you know. I'm like, I know it seems cliche, but I'm just begging you, please, anything will get you started. We got to keep your muscles healthy.
And I like to tell my patients, you have three best friends in your weight loss journey. Water, right, because of the dehydration, and that protein and strength training. And then I said myself, because then I can guide you and help you if the other things are not happening, right? But I think protein is key to not lose muscle. I've seen that. Now I've seen also the opposite, when the patient just does strength training, but we don't do nothing about the protein, they may still lose muscle or they may not gain muscle. It really, to build muscle, there has to be the protein and the strength training. To preserve muscle, I see more impact of protein than strength training.
Mm. So you're really pushing the protein shakes.
Well, yes, because we're putting them in drugs that are not going to let them eat 100 grams of protein.
Yeah.
Right. So
that's another thing for people to realize. Yeah, we can supplement and replace.
I have to get creative and just sneak in protein here and there.
What are you doing about all the shortages and the Mounjaro coupon?
I guess might as well just bring that up.
Let's just go into it.
The news, right?
Breaking.
That we just talked about breaking news this past week. While I was at ACE, where were you, by the way? You were supposed to go to Seattle to the ACE meeting with me. Anyways, yeah, you.
Me?
Anyways, you know, yeah, it was even the Novo reps didn't know until it like was breaking that suddenly there was going to be more shortages or reduced production or whatever of Wegovy, specifically the semaglutide that's at the dose for weight loss, approved for weight loss for obesity. Not necessarily, I didn't hear anything about Ozempic.
No, that's apparently fine.
But then at the same time, unfortunately, this is all going to be confounded by the expiration of the Mounjaro coupons, which were being used maybe beyond what they should have been over the last year. So yeah, what are your thoughts on all that stuff?
I mean, it really amazes me that such pharmaceuticals as Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk didn't anticipate that it was going to be so successful, these drugs, right?
Yeah, and yet I thought they did. I mean, and it's like we all did. How did they not? Exactly. They're the ones making billions of dollars.
And now with, I mean, and the WHO predicts that in 7 years, 50% of the population worldwide will have obesity. So this is just the tip point. This is just the tip point of, I think this is going to change the way we practice medicine.
Just the tip.
But I feel like it's hard to deal with the shortages, right? I think it's hard to deal with it. And it's just helping the patients to navigate the shortage. It's just month by month, week by week, working with pharmacies that provide it, pharmacies that don't provide it. I call it the Hunger Games because I see my receptionist and my assistant like calling pharmacies who has it, who doesn't have.
Hunger Games, right? That's crazy.
And unfortunately, until there's no more production, and more pharmaceuticals make their own type of incretin, right? Then we're going to see less of the shortage. But otherwise, the production does not meet the demand for sure.
And hopefully the cost too, because there are, you know, I think we've mentioned this on the podcast several times. There are plenty of very promising similar types of therapies coming through the pipeline. They're just not out yet. They're not FDA approved yet, but they certainly, we expect them to be several different ones. So hopefully supply cost can come down and still have all the benefits. But
I have my own personal opinion on that. Definitely medications should be more accessible for more people, right? Economically. But I also, if you think about plastic surgery, right? If you think about like liposuction, tummy tuck, all those surgeries that they do, because the patient wants to lose weight, right? Because the patient wants to slim down, and they cost, I mean, here in New York, you can spend $50,000 in something, right? I mean, if you think of the cost of surgery, even also bariatric surgery, if it's not covered, or the long-term complications of obesity and the money that is spent on that, I do feel we want to educate also the consumer and the general public that this is an investment in their health.
Yeah, you're right.
This is really, if you're going to spend money on something, definitely, and you need it, right? This is something that should be invested. Because can have a tummy tuck, you can have a liposuction, but you're still going to have diabetes. They're not touching your visceral fat, right?
Right.
You can still be metabolically unhealthy, but $20,000, $30,000 less. So versus investing in medication that actually is improving your metabolic health, your mental health, then let's think about numbers and what is worth investing our money on, right? I think more and more patients, hopefully, they'll start doing more weight loss medications than plastic surgery. I mean, there are different, like breast implants and other things will not replace that. But in plastic surgery to reduce mass, I think this is going to, should take over and invest money on that.
I heard in Mexico, though, it's like these Ozempic pens or Wegovy pens. I don't know if they have Wegovy down there, but it's only like 100 or 200 bucks.
That's the thing. Here in the U.S., the prices, right? Pretty much anywhere outside the U.S., I've heard more or less approximately of $200 per month.
That's ridiculous.
Yeah. I had a patient come see me from Florida who has a Brazilian connection. And he said a lot of his, you know, he knew a lot of people in Brazil who were getting it for, $200 to $300. Again, it was Ozempic, but, you know, whatever.
Whatever.
Yeah. And Mounjaro in Dubai is like $250.
Oh, my God.
Those people in Dubai have a lot of money.
Yeah.
So, okay, just for everybody that's listening, Wegovy, it's 1 milligram and below. They're going to see
the demand is just higher than the supply.
So hopefully nobody who's already on it maintaining, that shouldn't be an issue, according to our sources.
If they're already on 2.4, they should be fine. But I'm already seeing people that are on like 0.5 and they want to go to 1, it's gone. So it's like, do they need to jump up to 1.7? That's a huge jump.
Yeah, that's a huge jump.
And I don't know.
Well,
I don't know
if, there are ways around it. I don't know if we necessarily want to get into off-label stuff here. But, you know, so luckily we have samples. There are sometimes ways to get some off-label coverage. So, yeah, the Ozempic version of semaglutide, again, for everyone out there, same exact drug, different pen devices. So we can use those. But I know all three of us are on the same page, as are all real obesity specialists, endocrinologists, et cetera, that don't fall for the compounding semaglutide.
Every time I say that, people get really mad at me on TikTok. They think I'm just a big pharma shill. I'm like, I don't know what to tell you guys.
Yeah, I know. I mean, we have zero financial gain from the company that makes it. We just would never ourselves take or give to our patients compounded semaglutide because we just have no idea what the heck is it. Where are they getting it from? Apparently from China.
But I would argue a little bit further than that is who the person that's prescribing you a compounded semaglutide, I'm pretty sure they have no clue on how to manage these drugs.
Right. That should be a huge red flag in general.
It's a red flag, right? You can get, I think many people are just trying to get it and they don't care how it's giving it to them, which is a shame, right?
Yeah.
Again, they may be skinny fat or have complications that could have been prevented. But I would question more who's giving you, who's actually recommending the compounded semaglutide then. Yeah. Unlikely that any obesity specialist, unlikely that any endocrinologist will be recommending, which are the trust people that you would trust, right?
Yeah. Ironically, you know, they say, oh, you guys just follow the money to pharma money. But think about it. It's how ironic that is that we could make tons of money selling compounded semaglutide if we shield out for that. That's how that's what they're doing it for. They're doing it for the money, not for people.
And
I hate it.
If a cardiologist talks about a blood pressure medication, is he selling because of the money? That's our specialty. What else?
TikTok thinks that. TikTok. What people think. They think they're all doing that. It's horrible.
That's training. That's what we do. That's what we do every day. That's why we know it works for the patient. If somebody's talking about insulin, are you being sold by pharma just giving insulin to the patients?
Well, that's what they think. That's what they say. It's amazing.
Kickbacks for statins and stuff like that. Yeah, they're like, all right, well, what do you want? Like, I don't care. You don't have to take anything. Fine, whatever.
So anyways, everybody out there, just if your physician tells you, you know, suggests a certain medication because the benefits outweigh the risks and whatever your situation is, it's not because of pharma giving anybody any money. But, you know, there are issues with pharma. Don't get us wrong.
Yeah.
You can actually look it up. Open payments.
Yeah. Well, but hey, I like my lunch.
But even if you can discuss food industry, right? I mean,
it's horrible.
It's a multi-dollar business industry and has zero interest in the health of the consumers, right? They just want to make money. Environmental factors, the plastic, the pesticides. I mean, we have many things, but this is a treatment that we can actually do something for the patient. But is it the only cause or the only thing that will benefit? No, there's food industry could definitely improve environmental factors, the climate change, but they're very broad things for us to change that hopefully eventually will happen. But right now we have to concentrate on what we have and what we can do for the patient.
Talk about conflicts of interest out there. Holy cow. Yeah. Jeez. That's a whole nother thing.
Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. It's been a pleasure. We're going to have to, when we go to New York, we have to check out your little office.
Come.
Oh yeah.
See how your practice up there. I bet it's pretty swanky. So thanks so much for coming on.
She's like, I don't know about that.
But you know what? It's like never assume who will invest or not on their health.
Yeah.
I have all ranges. I have from people that clean houses to very high people, right? So it's just the interest in feeling better.
Yeah. But you're also, I guess the thing is you're not charging exorbitant prices. You're charging appropriate.
For New York.
Yeah, you're just a clinician clinic. You're not some med spa charging $1,000 to get compounded semaglutide like they do.
But you also have to value your work, right? Because again, much a plastic surgeon is going to charge for a tummy tuck and liposuction, improving their metabolic numbers, tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah,
right. What we are offering is very high, beyond just the external part. Right,
it's more important
quality health. Of life, quality of life improvement.
That's right. Thank you so much for coming on, everybody. Give us a review, share this with somebody it resonates with, and make sure if you're in New York and you want an endocrinologist, you got one right here with Dr. Salas Whalen.
Yeah. And free education on TikTok and Instagram.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, check her out. Check her out on Instagram and TikTok. She has great videos. Here's our outro.
This podcast is for entertainment and education and information purposes only. Remember, the physicians on this podcast are not your physician. It should not be considered professional or personalized medical advice. It should not be used to replace speaking with your physician or medical professional to discuss your specific health concerns. The topics discussed should not be used solely to diagnose or treat any condition. As a result, we are not responsible for any unwanted medical outcomes. The views and opinions discussed are of those of the host only and do not represent those of any other entities.
When you find a deal on your favorite thing in the McDonald's app and order it, does that technically count as online shopping? Save money with the app.
At participating McDonald's, prices may vary.